Policy debates in Washington have long been dominated by think tanks and academics who populate the marketplace of ideas. Today's guest argues new players are entering the field, such as global consultancies and billionaire-funded pet projects. He's Daniel Dresner, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Each week on Story in the Public Square, we try to understand the narratives shaping American public life. Joining us this week is a prolific scholar of international relations, Daniel W. Dresner, who is the author of six books. Is that right, six?
Six.
And is currently professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. His new book is The Ideas Industry. Dan, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, the ideas industry, some people call it the marketplace of ideas. What are we really talking about here?
We're talking about the sort of collection of academics and think tank fellows and private sector individuals and pundits and op-ed columnists who try to weigh in on public affairs or foreign affairs, the issues of the day, as it were. And you're right, I also call it the marketplace of ideas in the book. And the notion is that by doing these things, by writing, by taping podcasts, by giving TED Talks, you name it, hopefully we're going to be influencing either top-tier policymakers or the American public about how they should think about the world, how they should think about American foreign policy, about grand strategy. So the marketplace of ideas has been around for a while, but what's interesting over the last 30 years or so is in some ways it's never been bigger. It's industrialized, as it were. There are more media platforms now than there ever were before, and there's more people who are interested than ever before. And so as a result, the rewards are somewhat larger and more lucrative. And so that's what I meant by saying the ideas industry as opposed to the more commonplace notion of the marketplace of ideas.
More people are interested than ever before. Why? Is this the post 9/11 something, or is there something else in the mix?
So I think there are sort of three trends going on in American public life that have basically caused a sort of demand for new ideas out there. The first is the erosion of trust in expertise and authority. If you take a look at any kind of public opinion poll, whether we're talking about Pew or Gallup or what have you, the data show the same thing, which is basically since the mid-1960s, there's been a steady erosion of trust in just about every American institution out there except for the United States military. And this includes what we would consider expert institutions, whether we're talking about medicine or higher education, things like that. The average level of trust, according to a general social survey in 1972, was about 50%. 50% of Americans put a high degree of trust in those institutions. By 2012, it was down to 30%. Mm. So as a result, traditional experts no longer have the sort of same kind of authority. And so as a result, they're casting about for new ideas. The second trend is the polarization of the American public. Increasingly, we now sort of segment ourselves, not necessarily by race or by religion or by sexual orientation, but by political identity. And so as a result, hardcore Democrats and hardcore Republicans increasingly view the other side as not just opposed to them politically, but in some cases as evil or, you know, detrimental to the American way of life in a way that wasn't the case before. Indeed, there was one survey experiment that was conducted in the last 5 years that showed that people who were either extreme conservatives or extreme liberals were more likely to discriminate in terms of hiring based on political affiliation than based on race or gender. And so as a result, all of these ideological groups want their own house intellectuals, as it were. They're not necessarily interested in what we would consider traditional public intellectuals. And the last trend, and the most important, is the rise of economic inequality, particularly the rise not just of the 1%, but really the 0.01%. There's now a sort of new class of benefactors or plutocrats or what have you that have more money than they know what to do with. And it turns out what they want to do is go back to college. Mm-hmm. But they don't go back to college. What they actually do is create their own intellectual salons. And then they are looking for intellectuals to feed them, you know, new ideas, innovative ideas, what they would consider disruptive ideas about the way the world works. And then they want to promulgate those at TED, at the Davos World Economic Forum, at South by Southwest, you name it. There's a whole bunch of platforms.
So I want to zero in on a couple of these factors that you're citing here. Let's start with the erosion of trust. And of course, what you say is absolutely true. It's been tracked and polled and confirmed. What happened here? We used to trust our leaders. We used to trust our doctors. We used to trust people in academia. We used to trust our elected officials. What happened?
To be fair, what happened is that that trust was misplaced in some cases. So it's easy to sort of bemoan the trust of, oh, God, why can't we trust established authorities? Isn't that a shame? There's a degree to which a healthy degree of mistrust or skepticism is warranted. I mean, bear in mind, there's a reason why this started falling in the mid-60s. You immediately after that had the Vietnam War, in which the best and the brightest advocated conducting a conflict that wound up costing close to 50,000, more than 50,000 Americans who served there. You had Watergate, which also discredited a whole series of institutions. And then post 9/11, you did actually see a spike in trust after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. There was sort of the last moment when you can argue Americans really did unify behind trust in certain ideas. And then what happened? We invaded Afghanistan and we haven't left. We invaded Iraq, which was unrelated to Afghanistan, and we haven't left. And then the elites oversaw the biggest global economic crisis since the Great Depression. All of these things combined are going to lead to some genuine and justified mistrust of elites in terms of whether they know or not, whether they know what they're doing or not.
But is that a healthy element for a good functioning society to have such a high level of distrust?
Right. You can argue that there is a certain degree of skepticism is absolutely
warranted.
Yeah,
I mean, of course.
That's healthy.
That's just like common sense.
The problem is when it goes to the point where we are now, where there is so little trust in elites that you have certain segments of the population that don't believe it's proper to vaccinate your children, or that don't trust when the president says he was born in this country, that are more willing to listen to someone like Sean Hannity than someone with actual academic credentials.
I mean, I think certainly social media and the internet are a factor in this as well.
There's no doubt that that plays a certain role. I mean, the extent to which, essentially, Cass Sunstein used the phrase cyber balkanization back around the turn of the century and what we would now call cocooning, which is the notion that you are only going to click on or only going to follow or only going to pay attention to news stories, events, or ideas that essentially confirm whatever your pre-existing worldviews are. So that is certainly a problem. On the other hand, if you are willing to pay attention to a diversity of you know, ideological points of view, it also gives you exposure to different kinds of news stories or events that you might not otherwise be aware of.
Is it possible? Is it necessary? Do we need to rebuild the trust in expertise, the trust in these big institutions?
I think it would be good to rebuild some of this trust. Again, I think, you know, just blind loyalty to these institutions is as misplaced as the degree of cynicism that we have now. You do want to have some degree of trust in institutions, particularly if there is an actual emergency that emerges. Mm-hmm. Think about the Ebola outbreak that occurred in November 2014,
right,
where, you know, there were a few Ebola cases reported. The epidemic spread in West Africa. There were a few cases reported in Europe. And then there were one or two cases that emerged in the United States. That's the moment when you want the Center for Disease Control to be able to say, everyone relax, here are the protocols we're following. We have this, don't worry about it. And instead, what actually happened was you had states and localities, I believe the technical term is wigging out, in which, you know, you had, I believe, you know, you had Chris Christie in New Jersey quarantining a nurse for no good reason whatsoever. You had, I believe, a school in Louisiana asking a vice principal who had been in Zambia, which was 3,000 miles away from the actual Ebola outbreak, but because it was the same continent, was asked to stay home out of an abundance of caution. So yeah, those are the moments where you do want trust in institutions, I think, to be built up.
So you mentioned sort of the role, though, of sort of elected leaders in this particular case, but I'm wondering, I'm thinking, too, about President Trump's relationship with the Republican foreign policy establishment is not terrific. I think it's safe to say.
No, it's really bad.
And his basic critique of them is, well, why should I listen to them? They let us into Iraq.
Right.
Right. So there's clearly there's A, that's a true statement, but B, it's also, I think you're saying, disruptive to the marketplace of ideas and the fair litigation of people with expertise.
Well, so one way to think about Donald Trump is, and this is not something that is commonly thought about him, but if you think about Trump as an intellectual, he's what I call in the book a thought leader. So I talk about two different types of intellectuals in the book. The sort of traditional intellectual, public intellectual, is Isaiah Berlin's fox. So a fox knows a little bit about a lot. They're critics. They can tell you everything that's wrong with everyone else's idea. So these people are generally acknowledged to be experts, and they will opine on other matters. And you can argue that a lot of the Republican foreign policy establishment consists of public intellectuals. But then there are thought leaders. Thought leaders are Isaiah Berlin's hedgehogs, which is they know one big thing, and they think that thing can explain everything. And weirdly, Trump, although he's not generally thought of as an intellectual, acted like a thought leader. He basically said, all of these other guys are idiots. You know, they were responsible for getting us into Iraq, and that was dumb. And to be fair, what was interesting about that was, in some ways, he was the first leading GOP presidential candidate to actually say that.
Yeah.
And indeed, in his big foreign policy speech in April of 2016, he talked about shaking the rust off of America's foreign policy establishment. And if you paid attention to American foreign policy over the last 15 years, there was at least some degree of resonance in that message. The problem is that while, to be sure, America's foreign policy establishment has gotten some big things wrong, they also know a fair amount. They've gotten some big things right as well. And we're now seeing what happens when you actually have a president and a secretary of state with no foreign policy experience whatsoever coming to the plate and not realizing that there's a certain reason why there are certain norms in place.
Begs the question, so does the term thought leader apply to Donald Trump half a year into his presidency?
Yeah, Donald Trump is still the brassiest thought leader in existence. There's no denying that. I mean, this is someone who has a few big ideas about how he thinks he can make America great again. He thinks if we restrict illegal immigration, if we somehow rejigger trade deals, if we take the oil, however we're supposed to be doing that, and somehow get our allies to contribute more in terms of defense spending, this is all somehow going to be some sort of, you know, it's like the South Park underpants gnomes, underwear gnomes, in which, you know, we do these things, a few question marks, and then eventually America profits again. In point of fact, most of these ideas, the ones that actually do have some small amount of merit to them, really would make a difference on the margins at best. But what's interesting is the degree to which he has stuck to his guns on most of these issues. If there's one thing Donald Trump is really, really bad at, it's at ever admitting that he's wrong. He can't do that. And in some ways, that is consistent with most thought leaders. The power that thought leaders have in the marketplace of ideas is the supreme and total confidence that they are right. And they're hardly unique to the private sector. I'm an academic. I'll go to seminars or presentations right in my wheelhouse, and I'll be hearing something, someone presenting something, and I'm thinking, I don't think that's right, but wow, they sound really sure about themselves. Maybe they are right. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, and confidence is in and of itself a tool of the trade.
But at some point, a thought leader, if the thoughts aren't being embraced any longer, and I think we're seeing that with the Trump presidency. I heard driving in here, the latest Gallup poll, his approval rating is down to 36%. It's dropped 11% even among Republicans. At some point, a thought leader becomes a thought what?
Well, so one of the things I argue that happens in the book, one of the arguments I make in the book is that essentially, because of these forces that I've talked about, thought leaders are ascendant and public intellectuals are not quite as strong as they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, weirdly, it means that the marketplace of ideas is now like the marketplace for capital, which means there are bubbles. There are bubbles that emerge. So there are ideas that will emerge and will gain some degree of faddishness and probably be applied or be embraced far out of proportion to their actual correctness. And you can argue to some extent Trump, you know, epitomizes this in the sense of it worked well enough for him to get elected, and we're now seeing the stress test of these ideas actually go into play. And as you note, you know, he's increasingly unpopular with significant amounts of the voting populace. And it's one thing to say in a campaign, I will make these ideas work. It's another thing for them to actually work. And as it turns out, what Trump did not realize is that there are things like courts and Congress And these other institutions, pesky things that are in the Constitution.
Yeah, like the Constitution.
Right,
yeah.
That make it impossible for him to just sort of say, I will make this so, and then it becomes so.
Do you think he really didn't realize that?
Yeah, I think he's that stupid. I really do.
We're going to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Southern Virginia University, and you can follow me on Twitter at JM Lutis. To my right is award-winning journalist from the Providence Journal, G. Wayne Miller. He's on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. An audio version of Story in the Public Square can be heard three times each weekend on Sirius XM Channel 124. That's the POTUS channel, Politics of the United States. Subscribers can also download episodes anytime on the SiriusXM app. Our guest this week is the author of six books ranging on everything from economic statecraft to zombies. Yes, I said zombies. Dan Dresner is professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's prolific on Twitter and a very entertaining follow. You should follow him at Dan Dresner. Dan, D-R-E-Z-N-E-R. So, Dan, one of the conclusions of the ideas industry is that groups like McKinsey and Company, a hugely profitable global consultancy, are beginning to play the role that traditional nonprofit think tanks used to play. What is the danger in that, and is there some benefit to it as well?
Right. The danger is that essentially for-profit actors like McKinsey often produce quality research. I've relied on some of their research. So to be clear, I'm not trying to say that they're necessarily automatically worse than, let's say, the product of a Brookings or a Council on Foreign Relations or so forth. The problem that McKinsey has is that very often the research or reports that they produce rely on data that other external referees or academics like myself can't access, that they're essentially relying, in terms of their reports, on the proprietary data that they generate from their consulting services. So they have a legitimate justification to say, look, we can't make this available to you because that would breach the confidentiality of our clients, which is perfectly fine. But then the problem is that you don't have other experts that can fact check these things to make sure whether or not they're actually true or not.
That's a tradition in the academy that is well established. Independently verifiable information,
peer-reviewed publication, of course,
is essential.
Right, and if anything, there's been a stronger push towards data transparency over the last 10 years. Because of a rash of scandals involving, scholarly work that has turned out
fraudulent research.
Right, exactly, fraudulent research. So, I mean, to be fair, it's not like the academy is perfect, but we're also self-correcting to some extent. We're trying to make it a little bit better. And think tanks are similar in terms of emulating the academy, in terms of trying to make their research as transparent as possible. The problem becomes, again, where trying to access the for-profit work becomes difficult. And I think there's another bias in some ways that the McKinseys or the Eurasia groups of the world are able to trade in on, which is, weirdly enough, because they are explicitly for-profit, there is an assumption by policymakers and even by the public that because they are making a buck, they must be doing something of some value, which is a think tank is a nonprofit institution. A university is a nonprofit institution. If I'm a professor and I'm so smart, I should be like running my own firm or making much more money than I do. Whereas on the other hand, someone who's working for a McKinsey or for Goldman Sachs or what have you, the very fact that they are earning that much is somehow attributed to them a greater intellectual value than perhaps they might actually merit. And so that bias is problematic as well.
So can you explain how a McKinsey works? I mean, who works for them, how they get their ideas, how they make their money? I mean, I know very little about how they operate or even where they're headquartered or who their clients might be or how it works. I understand how a university works. I think we probably all do. Talk about that.
Well, business and management consulting, actually, they really got their origins during the Great Depression. Everyone knows about the Glass-Steagall laws that separated investment banks from commercial banks. But one of the other laws that was passed, I believe it was the Securities Act, essentially prevented banks from offering the kind of consulting services that the McKinseys of the world now provide, which is to say, how can they improve business operations, make them more efficient, make them better organized, and so forth. And as a result, what wound up happening was the McKinseys of the world soon realized that the best way they could make money was not to necessarily do sort of grunt level, sort of improving operations on a shop floor, but rather appeal to what we would call C-suite, which is to say the executive suite. Essentially, the McKinseys of the world started acting like a white shoes law firm to say, we will offer the best kind of advice as a way to improve how you at the corporate level should do your job better. And this has actually worked for them. It's been a great business model for them. And as a result, McKinsey retains a fair amount of their client base over a long period of time. They don't just go in, swoop in, and sort of suggest things to do in a one-off. I think something like 75% of their client base is repeat customer service. The advantage of this for McKinsey is, if you work there, is you actually do get exposed to an awful lot of not just the U.S. economy, but the global economy. And a significant source of their servicing now, of their contracting, is not just for-profit clients. They also work for the U.S. government, but not just the U.S. government, the Saudi Arabian government, other governments in the world, in terms of things like regulatory compliance and what have you. And as a result of doing those sorts of things, they actually have a fair amount of intelligence about the rest of the world. They don't bring nothing to this marketplace of ideas. They actually do have some value. I just worry about whether the biases that we're talking about give them more influence than they probably should.
Are there any specific examples of how this change in the ideas industry is changing either policy or the policy ideas that are being brought to the table for discussion in the councils in Washington, for example?
Well, certainly you can argue that, for example, perhaps one of the reasons why the Trump administration is doing has sort of tightened its relationship with Saudi Arabia is in no small part because McKinsey, among other things, has been a chief consultant for Saudi Arabia in terms of engaging in Saudi economic reforms. Indeed, one of the nicknames for the Saudi economic ministry is the McKinsey ministry because they've offered so much in the way of reform. But that creates an informal channel between the Saudi government and people in Washington to get a sense of the degree to which they can trust the Saudis on these issues. And you can argue that part of the reason that particularly the Trump administration might trust the Saudis is because Trump does think like a businessman. And so as a result, when he sees a country trying to organize itself according to sort of best business practices, he might think, I'm more inclined to trust them.
I can't go any further without asking about theories of international politics and zombies. Great title. Eye-catching. What's it about?
It's a book that came out about 6 or 7 years ago that asked the very, very important question, what would different theories of international politics predict would happen in the world if the dead should start to rise from the grave and feast upon the living?
Wow, that's a TV series, too. The
title is a play on a classic work of international relations theory by Ken Waltz called Theory of International Politics. And when I started writing the book, it was just when that book Pride and Prejudice and Zombies came out. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, okay, clearly any book that you can just tack on and zombies to the end of it is cool. So I figured that was the title. I mean, and that is without question the most self-explanatory title I will ever produce.
Did you come up with the title yourself? Or?
I did. Not only that, I came up with the title. My press actually wanted to change it. They wanted to make it something like When Zombies Attack or something like that. And I normally defer to editors, I mean, on this. They know their job better than I do. But this was one of the few times where I stood my ground and said, no, people who study international relations will get the joke. And furthermore, it's just funny.
It is funny.
So there's a narrative that hasn't been fully engaged around the Trump presidency. And it's the idea that Donald Trump is an exceptional president. And we've seen this a little bit in the recent debate about the Senate passed a new sanctions package for Russia. In response to Russia's behavior in Syria, but also their intervention in the American election. You wrote for the Washington Post, quote, I'm not sure how I would feel if anyone else was president besides Trump. Explain that. Explain your hesitancy for our audience.
So the basic problem here is that the last institution you want in the United States to run foreign policy is the United States Congress. Congress is bad at running foreign policy, mostly because, first of all, to be fair, it's 535 people. An awful lot of these 535 people don't know that much about foreign policy. And furthermore, they don't care. And they're not necessarily wrong in not caring, because in order to get reelected, you know, in their home districts, most of their voters don't care about foreign policy either. So it's not wrong for them to necessarily be ill-informed about this. The problem comes in that over the last 50 years or so, there's been a slow shift in authority in terms of foreign policy from Congress to the executive branch. The executive branch, essentially, and the president is supposed to function as the grown-up in the room mm-hmm. when it comes to foreign policy. You know, members of Congress can pursue their own district's narrow interests, but presumably the president should be pursuing the national interest. What is interesting in the Trump era is the very fact that you have Congress voting, you know, 98-2 essentially, to tie the president's hands when it comes to sanctions against Russia, when it comes to sanctions against Iran. This is highly unusual. Congress normally engages in symbolic actions, but does not actually want to really tie the president's hands, mostly because they don't want the responsibility.
Right.
Congress wants respect. They don't want responsibility over foreign affairs. But because we've given so much power to the president, and because this president seems so manifestly unfit when it comes to foreign policy, Congress almost has no choice but to say, okay, we've got to put up more powerful guardrails. We can't let the executive branch, you know, veer off the sort of accepted highway when it comes to how foreign policy should be pursued, because he has some ideas that are genuinely bad, and some ideas that are genuinely reckless or dangerous. And so as a result, we're now seeing for the first time in a long time Congress trying to claim some authority back from the president, which in some ways is appropriate. As I said, with this administration, I think that's a good thing to do. My concern is that while Congress, for example, is very, very eager to impose sanctions on countries, they're really bad at lifting those sanctions.
Case in point, Cuba.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, the problem is that if you keep doing this, Congress will just pass sanctions bill after sanctions bill after sanctions bill, in which we're sanctioning an ever-increasing number of countries without ever eliminating those sanctions. And if the point of sanctions is to coerce another actor, another country, into changing their foreign policy, why should they do that if they don't believe that Congress will ever change its mind? Mm.
Do you think that the bill with Russia, would that even withstand judicial scrutiny?
Yes, it would withstand judicial scrutiny. I have no doubt about that. The Constitution actually affords Congress a fair amount of powers in terms of foreign policy. Congress has voluntarily, however, generally tended to defer to the executive branch. Congress acting in this way is fully consistent with the Constitution, so they'd be totally within their purview to do that.
It's a fascinating conversation, and you're a fascinating guest. Dan Dresner, thank you so much for being with us. The book is The Ideas Industry. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can visit pellcenter.org, where you can also catch up on earlier episodes. I'm Jim Lutis. He's G. Wayne Miller. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll join us again next week for more Story in the Public Square.